this block of DNA here really does look like a pathogenicity island because of the GC content plus the genetic linkage of all of these genes. Now, it's missing some of those other components that I talked about, which is the tRNA being associated with it, so that that would be the site where it's inserted. It doesn't have inverted repeats at the ends here. This might be a really ancient pathogenicity island in that sense. It doesn't have it, or has evolved, so it's lost some of those other components. But there are bona fide pathogenicity islands in Shigella, in the chromosome, and those are shown here as SHI 1, 2, and 3. And this really just gives you a flavor for the diversity of pathogenicity islands, even within a single pathogen. So the one pathogenicity island, which is inserted near another tRNA gene, encodes enterotoxins and proteases, perhaps even a mucinase, which may allow the bacteria to get down into the epithelial cell layer, getting through the glycocalyx, which covers the mucosal surface. One pathogenicity island also encodes genes for acquisition of iron. These are the Arabactin operon, for Arabactin synthesis and transport. And in the two different species of Shigella, Shigella flexuri and Shigella boardii, there are two different types of pathogenicity island, both of which contain the same group of genes. That is, they have genes for Arabactin synthesis and transport. But they're different, and they have evolved differently because the pathogenicity islands were inserted in different places in these two different species of Shigella. This slide illustrates something which is historically of importance and perhaps even evolutionarily of importance, and that is that the earliest pathogenicity islands that were described all were associated with synthesis of secretory secretion systems. Now, is that just fortuitous because that's what people were studying and that's where they found the genes, or is this really relevant to the evolution of pathogenicity islands? That's, I think, still open to debate. But in the case of Salmonella, there are several, maybe up to five now, different secretion systems that are utilized specifically for secretion of virulence determinants. These two are critical, and these are the two first which were described, SPI 1 and 2. These are pathogenicity islands in the chromosome of Salmonella. They're important for invasion and post-invasion events. The Lee locus, as I mentioned, in EPEC and EHEC, encodes a type 2 secretion system for these respective pathogens. So historically, there was a close association between identification of these type 2 secretion systems in pathogens and the presence of the genes for these systems on pathogenicity islands. Now, let's go to the other extreme. Did you think? Yes.
I'm sorry, just to go back real quick. Can you explain what a type 3 secretion system?
Oh, we didn't get the type 2 secretion system? No. Okay. A type 2 secretion system, and we'll talk about this next week when we talk about secretion of bacteria, is a dedicated machinery that allows gram-negative pathogens to transport molecules from the cytoplasm directly across the inner membrane and outer membrane out to the surface of the bacteria and beyond. When we speak of secretion, we're talking about going from cytoplasm to the outer surface of the bacteria and or into the medium. And there are different types of secretion systems that are associated with these virulence functions. And we're up to like six, I think, distinct different mechanisms of secretion of virulence determinants. And this is distinct from the general secretory pathway that's used for moving molecules from cytoplasm across the inner membrane and then across the outer membrane. And we'll talk about that next week. Yes.
So why do they secrete this secretion?
Why do they secrete these? If you think about how pathogens interact with their host, there are a variety of different things that they do. They attach, they invade, they stimulate, and all of these things have to happen with some type of molecules that are on the surface of the bacterium or secreted by the bacterium. So if you think about the problems that gram-negative bacteria have, it's compounded by the fact that they don't just have one membrane, they have two. They're not gram-positive, they have two membranes. So the bacteria has to have a way of moving proteins that it synthesizes within the cytoplasm to the outside of the bacteria if it's going to interact with eukaryotic cells, whether they're plants, animals, or higher mammals. So that's why these systems have evolved. So I'm sorry, I probably should have mentioned that a little bit earlier, but we'll talk about this in more detail next week when we talk about secretion. So now that I talked about pathogenicity islands, I want to also mention that not all pathogens have. And in fact, if you look at some of these obligate intracellular pathogens such as chlamydia and rickettsia, there doesn't appear to be any linking of virulence genes per se in these organisms. And there are genes which look like they encode a type 3 secretion system for chlamydia. But unlike all of the other organisms that have type 2 secretion systems, like Yersinia, like Salmonella, like E. coli, like Shigella, where the genes are linked, in chlamydia, they're all over the map. They're all over the genome. So it's not a hard and fast rule that genes which are working together for virulence in a pathogen have to be linked. It certainly is not the case in these organisms. So there may be some implications of this for evolution, because these two organisms are not free living organisms. They're obligate intercellular organisms, which have reduced genome sizes. So perhaps this has some role in the explanation for why the virulence genes aren't linked in these pathogens. I think it's easy to imagine if you look at the Salmonella system, for example, we have this group of genes which are in the chromosome that encode a type 2 secretion system, that if acquired these genes from somewhere, that the pathogenic islands look like old mobile genetic elements. They came in and are there. You can make the same argument perhaps for chlamydia, but then you have to explain why they're all scattered throughout the genome. But it's harder to explain the evolutionary acquisition of these types of genes in chlamydia in the context of the model that you have Salmonella or E. coli. Particularly if you ask me, well, what about the GC content of these genes in chlamydia? And I would say, well, what about, what was your question? So are you going to ask that question? Jay, are you going to ask that question?
Of course.
Oh, yeah. Well, so tell me, what's GC content of the type 3 secretion system like genes in chlamydia? Do they look like the rest of the chlamydia genome? Oh, are you going to ask that question?
Do they?
They do. They don't look like they're any different. So you could look at the genome and say, okay, 38%, whoop, 22%. Another couple of genes, 22%. They must be virulence. So that means that somewhere in the evolutionary scheme for these intracellular pathogens, they're losing genes, and the genes that they have, which are allowing them to do the kinds of things that they do in interacting with these cells and living inside the cells, those genes start to look more and more like the rest of the core genome. That's all part of the evolution. So that gets us to the question of the origin of pathogenicity. Where did they come from in the first place? Well, these are a couple of explanations. Could be that they were bacteriophages. We know bacteriophages can contribute to bacterial evolution because they can bring genes in from other hosts. They can transfer genes from a donor to a recipient. So they are capable of transferring groups of genes. We saw that in generalized transduction. So it could be a pathogenicity allowance is a type of lysogenic conversion that's not permanent. And I should ask, parenthetically, did you still all remember what lysogenic conversion means? Anybody not know what it means? Okay, who wants to explain it to Andrew and to Riley? I'm not singling you guys out, but I want to see if everyone else is being honest, because they didn't raise their hands. You guys, good for you, you raised your hands. Let me mention this. I think I might have mentioned it before. My PhD mentor in graduate school told us that it's not a sin to be ignorant. Semicolon. It's a sin to remain ignorant. So if you don't know something, ask. Don't be afraid. So who can speak on explaining lysogenic conversion? Yeah.
Well, the
Okay, what you described is lytic induction of a lysogen. That's not lysogenic conversion. Okay. We move to this side of the room, then we'll do this. Who else? Come on. That's the formation of a lysogen. But the concept of lysogenic conversion is more than that. That's also when it's a lysogen. What's lysogenic conversion? No, that's a defective license. Okay, so we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4, we got 17 there. Let's keep going, come on, come on, come on. You gotta know this.
Is it what it stays in the genome, even like after bacteria replicates, it keeps going, like, it goes into the daughter cells?
That's the normal state of a lysogen. It just gets replicated because it's part of the chromosome. Lysogen conversion. Yeah, that's Abraham and excision, these specialized transcripts. This is a good review, right? Just keep giving me stuff that it's not. And then we'll eventually get through the whole course. There's gotta be someone here who's like flipping through the back of the book and looking it up in the boxes, right? Yeah, there we go, there we go. Okay, I'm gonna tell you what it is. Lysogenic conversion is when you have a lysogen that not only is inserted into the chromosome or in the genome, right? So it's a lysogen, the prophage state. And it's keeping itself in its prophage state just by repressing expression of its lytic cycle genes, right? But it also is a genome, the bacteriophage genome, contains other genes which impart another phenotype to the bacteria, to the host. So when we talk about the genes in Cyanobacterium diphtheria, which encodes diphtheria toxin, where are the toxin genes found? Found on a Cyanobacteria page. Exactly. That's your classic example of lysogenic conversion. If the Cyanobacterium diphtheria does not have that bacteriophage, if it's not lysogenic for the bacteriophage, it's not pathogenic because it doesn't have the gene for the toxin. The genes encoded on the bacteriophage. That's lysogenic conversion. So if you think about these pathogenesis, you can start thinking like, well, maybe it was at some point in time the bacteriophage that came in had these other genes and lost its ability to stop, lost its ability to come out. That's the interesting thing is that some of these genes have their own promoters that are independently expressed so that even though all of the other phage genes are repressed, so the phage doesn't go lytic, these other genes, like the genes for the toxin, do get expressed. Yes. Right? Where do those genes come from? Now you're going back in time. That's a good question. Who knows the origins of these particular toxins? These other genes, where they come from originally. So the Cyanobacteriophage must have got that gene from someplace. Who knows where it came from? Well, the bacteriophage doesn't need any of these things. So a lot of these things happen by just random mutation, random association. Another example would be collar toxin. Collar toxin is encoded by a bacteriophage and affects the root collar. Lambda. There's a lambda-like phage that encodes the Shiga toxin, which is found in Emerichia coli. Those of you who are taking MedMichael should know that. And you should have associated that with lysogenic conversion too. The toxin is on the phage. Where did the phage get it initially? Well, you know a little bit about how lysogens form and then how lysogens are induced. If they're in the chromosome and they induce out of the chromosome, they can pick up genes which are adjacent to them in the site where they insert into the chromosome, right? That's when we talk about specialized transduction. So these phages that also encode some toxins are probably the result of a type of specialized transduction. Maybe an aberrant excision where they popped out and took out some chromosomal DNA along with them from a previous host. Alternatively, and we'll talk about this, well, we did talk about it, and we'll talk about transposons, right? Transposons hop. What was the slide I showed you on Tuesday? Transposons can hop from plasmid to chromosome, chromosome to plasmid, and if there are phages in there, if it's just part of the chromosome, then transposons can hop into them too. So you can actually, and in fact it was found when people were studying transposon TN5, Doug Bird initially described TN5 because he used lambda to pull it out. He infected a strain that had TN5 in it and pulled out a lambda lysate, which now contain phage particles that were able to transduce kanamycin resistance, which is drug marker on TN5. So the transposons can hop also on the bacteriophage. That may be at the root of the evolution of some of these things. Now keep in mind, when you ask questions like this, that generally there aren't any answers. You can speculate, and it might be difficult or impossible to prove these speculations because many of the ancestors that gave rise to these structures or to these organisms may not exist out there anymore. So you couldn't go back and say, well, give me the predecessor of such and such a pathogen. It may be gone because it's no longer fit in the environment. So it's hard to answer some of these questions, but we can speculate based on our knowledge of how these things look and how they behave, and maybe even make some predictions about where they're going in the future. I think that's really some of the excitement and the interest in thinking of these organisms from an evolutionary perspective. Knowing where they're coming from gives you an idea of how they function, how they got to where they are. So another possibility is plasmids. Plasmids include groups of genes which are linked, right? They may have integrated and perhaps lost their origin of replication, or they become inactive origins of replication, and then these become your pathogenicity options. Transposable elements, same thing, okay? So this last point is, why tRNA genes? I mentioned, made a point about these pathogenicity islands tending to be found within or close to tRNA genes. So what's the reason for that? If I don't have the answer on the next slide, I'm going to just ask you to think about that. Is that okay? The answer's not on this slide. Good. Just think about that. Why tRNA genes? Why do the pathogenicity islands have a particular predilection for tRNA genes? Okay. After these things happen, and getting back to the original question of the origins, it's like going back to the original origins of the comic superheroes, the origins of Spider-Man and Iron Man. You guys all know those, right? No? Yeah. Geez, do some homework. Think about your cultural heroes. Know what the origins are. It's not enough just for these things to happen. Something frequently needs to happen in order to allow these new genes to be assimilated in the new host. It's got to be adapted. And the first point is stable integration. So if you've got a plasmid integrating into the chromosome, that plasmid just as likely to pop out again, right? So three things have to happen in order for these events to be stabilized in the host. So maybe some genes need to be inactivated. Transposons. They hop. You want to keep a transposon in place. Maybe these pathogens now started out as transposable elements. Stabilizing would require an activation of which gene? Transposases, right? Okay? I mentioned on the previous slide, the plasmids. If the plasmids have their own origin of replication and they're integrated into a chromosome, you've got conflicts of replication force. So those origins have to be inactivated in some way in order to stabilize. So these are just a couple of examples of things that have to happen on the evolutionary scale for these genetic rearrangements to be stably assimilated in the new host. And not a trivial problem is the problem of expression of those genes. We talked about the genes which may be on bacteriophages. How do they get expressed if the phage is shutting down expression of its own genes? So some of these pathogenicity genes actually get themselves wired into the regulatory surface of the host so that they now have evolved to become responsive to certain host factors, the bacterial host factors. So the gene for Shiga toxin in enterohemorrhagic coli tends to be induced when the bacterial host is in trouble and starts to go into the SOS response. And that's when the toxin genes in the EHEC really get upregulated. Okay? So that's an example of where the genes in these pathogenicity islands, or in this case, on the lysogenic converting bacteriophage, get wired into the regulatory surface of the host bacteria. And again, codon usage is important. These genes all have particular codons for different amino acids, and the host organism itself has certain preference for different codons to be used. These pathogenicity islands tend to drift toward the commonly used or the more commonly used codons in the bacterial host. So they adapt in that way by random spontaneous mutation. Okay, let me just briefly mention a couple of concepts of evolution, then we'll talk about gene fusion. So bacterial plasmids contribute to bacterial evolution. I think it's pretty obvious how they do this because they mediate horizontal gene transfer. And this is a major contributing factor to the evolution of bacteria, both at the level of being able to transfer groups of genes that are linked, because plasmids can be small, they can be large, so they can have large groups of genes associated together, which in a single genetic step can impart a new phenotype, completely new phenotype on the recipient. So this is why we talk about a quantum leap in evolution for some of these pathogens. Because you can transfer a bacteria from one bacterial host, a group of genes on a plasmid into another, you can impart a whole new phenotype. Another example of this would be obviously multiple antibiotic resistance, which can be found on a single plasmid. So you can go from a drug sensitive strain to a strain now which is resistant to multiple antibiotics. All as a result of a single quantum leap by the transfer of a plasmid from one donor to the recipient. So these are some easy examples to imagine about how plasmids contribute to bacterial evolution. Phages do the same thing. Phages, by their nature, because they can lyse bacteria, apply selective pressure that can drive bacteria in a population to become resistant, because those are the ones that would survive. But beyond that, phages, as we saw last week, are capable of horizontal gene transfer by lysosomal conversion, by generalized transduction, specialized transduction. These are all different ways that phages can transfer genes horizontally. They are different in this, from plasmids in the sense that they have a much more limited host range. Plasmids tend to be spread more widely. In fact, there you have many examples of cross-species transfer of plasmid genes by conjugation, whereas phages are limited by the host range, the presence of receptors on the sensitive bacteria, and phages can be lytic and not lysogenic at all. And those phages really have a much, much more restricted ability to transfer genes, because what they do is they infect and they kill. So it's really the lysogenic phages, the ones which are capable of going into the lysogenic state, which would be contributing to the bacterial evolution. And finally, the transposable elements, you think about what we talked about on Tuesday, they hop, and they hop at random, and they can go into genes, and when they do hop into genes, they inactivate the genes. What we did talk about is that the consequence of transposition of transposons into operons. They may have polar effects. That is, if they hop into an early gene in the operon, they can shut down expression of genes distal to the insertion site. So the genes further down in the operon don't get expressed either. So single insertion in LAC-Z, for example, may block the expression of the downstream genes, LAC, Y, and K. In addition, some transposons have promoters that actually point outward, away from the transposon. So when the transposon hops into a piece of DNA, the promoter, which is on the outside end of the transposon, may direct expression into genes that are adjacent to the surface site. So you may get outward promoters that can activate genes. Gene fusions we'll talk about in a moment. Transposable elements, as we saw, also allow genes to be linked. We saw the evolution of these transposable elements and having multiple antibiotic resistance genes associated with them, for example, in the evolution of R factors. So what I'd like to leave you with when we talk about evolution, and this may be a topic for an entirely new course, is that you think about the organism as having a core gene pool, and then look at the flexible gene pool. And what are the things that contribute to each of those pools? So the first pool, the gene pool, which is the core, are the genes that encode these essential core functions. Making proteins, making structures for the cell envelope, key metabolic pathways, making the things that the bacteria need in order to grow, making the enzymes for replicating DNA. Those are core functions you would expect to find in the four genes, maybe on the chromosome. And the flexible gene pool, then, are those things which, for the most part, you can think of as being dispensable for growth. They would be found on these islands, on phages, on plasmids, on transposons, and they would encode things like virulence determinants. They would encode things like drug resistance, degradation of certain compounds, secondary metabolism, the enzymes which are necessary for movement of these genetic elements. So these together give you the organisms that we see in nature today. The core pool is what's built upon. And then you have facets that come in which contribute in this fashion to the pool pool. It gives us the vast diversity of microbial life that we see out there. Okay, so what I'd like to talk about for the second hour is gene fusions. You guys want to take a break or should we just continue? It's colder here, isn't it? Yeah. Let's take 5 minutes and then we'll pick up again. Focus on how you use these genetic molecules as tools to do molecular biology. So I'm going to focus on transposons as part of the tools, but we'll also talk about gene fusions, which have been constructed in vitro. But I think initially, in order to understand that, we need to have a good grasp of the different types of fusions. And we'll talk about operon fusions, which are also called transcriptional fusions. And we'll talk about protein fusions, which are translational fusions. And these are fundamentally different types of genetic fusions. Now, fusions and transposons in general are very, very useful because, as we talked about transposons in nature, they're essentially random with respect to the insertions that they make. So for a geneticist, these are really useful tools because you can then generate high frequencies of mutations with a low rate of mutagenesis. When we talked about making mutants in the first lecture, we talked about having have a fine line between mutagenizing too little and mutagenizing too much. Of course, it's hard to get the exact balance there where you can get generate either too few mutants or too many mutants. If you get too many, it would be because you have a high level of mutagenesis, you can get more mutations. Using transposons, eliminates that problem because you can get a high frequency of insertion and a low level of mutagenesis, meaning that essentially you get a minimal number of multiple events. And you can control that. Because if you get multiple events, that's your genetic nugget, you want to avoid it. Another nice feature of transposons is that the genes that get interrupted tend to lose function. Now you can think of exceptions to the rule where you get an insertion at the extreme 3' end of the gene, which perhaps gives you a truncated gene product that still maintains activity. But in general, you can think about transposon mutagenesis, which leads to gene interruption, meaning loss of gene function. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, you can get polarity on downstream genes or incomplete polarity of just several of those genes or reduced expression. The insertions themselves behave as point mutations if you map them, so it'll look as if they're just a single point mutation, even though the insertion may be 5 or 10 kilobases in size. The insertions can revert. We talked about how transposons can insert. They can pop out again because they are, after all, mobile genetic elements. They also, in excising, can generate deletions. So just as we saw phage lambda can excise from its prophage state by an aberrant excision event, so too can you get aberrant excisions of transposable elements. So they can create deletions in downstream genes or upstream genes. The insertions provide a portable region of defined DNA homology. What do I mean by this? This you can think of in the context of, again, evolution of molecules. So we talked about F-plasmids. And we talked about the structure of the F-plasmid. They had the transfer or the trigenes on them, but they also had different insertion sequences on them. To think about how the F-plasmid integrates into the chromosome to produce HFRs, where do you think the crossover is going to occur for the plasmid to integrate into the chromosome? Knowing this new piece of information. No one asked the question because you probably all just took them on faith that F-plasmids can integrate into the chromosome to generate HFRs. I didn't tell you how that happened. Now I'm asking you to think. Why do you think that happened?
Any transposon in the plasmid is, I think, it integrates into the chromosome.
It integrates into the chromosome.
And then there is an homology between the chromosome and the plasmid.
There's got to be a homology. Right. So where's the homology between the chromosome and the plasmid for the plasmid to integrate into the chromosome?
The position of the insertion of the transposon?
Which transposon? The F-plasmid. I'm talking about the F-plasmid, right? We're on the right track. Anyone want to help me out? There's one hanging. Come on, David, help me out.
Is it a transcription sequence?
Is it the insertion sequence? Is it the insertion sequences? Actually, it is. Yeah. Is it the insertion? It's the insertion sequence, right? Chromosome has insertion sequences in it. The F plasma has insertion sequences too. And not surprisingly, if you map where these HFRs integrate, or where the F plasmids integrate to generate HFRs, they tend to integrate where the insertion sequences are. Across the homologous regions. That's what we mean by saying this portable region of homology. So if that region is on the plasmid and it's on the chromosome, you can get a crossover, right? Homology recombination. So that's another way that insertion sequences or transposons can operate. They can provide these portable regions of homology. So, if you want to harness the power of transposons for doing genetic analysis, what are the features that you need in a good transposon system? Well, first of all, you want to be sure that it randomly hops. And one of the things we talked about last time was that, for the most part, the transposons that we talked about hop randomly. TN7 is one of the exceptions to the rule. It has a specific place in the E. coli chromosome where it hops. Bacteriophage mu, random. TN5, random. TN10, random. Okay, so these are all good tools to use for doing random transposon mutagenesis. You want to have a high frequency of transposition because, after all, geneticists are lazy. I'll say that again. We are lazy. We want the bacteria to do the work. And if you've got a transposon that doesn't hop very frequently, it's no good to you. Get another one. So if you want the bacteria to do the work and you don't want to have to wait and look through more events than you need to. So high frequency of transposition, randomness, stability. You want the hop to be relatively stable. You don't want things going in and out because then it's harder to do your genetic analysis. You have to have a selectable marker. And all the transposons we talked about to date are based on the early transposons that we described, which tended to be encoding antibiotic resistance. So there's your selectable marker. TN5 encodes antimycin resistance. TN10 encodes anthracycline resistance, okay? You want the transposon to have a broad host range. And if it's really just an enzymatic event that's dictating the transposition, then any DNA is fair game. All you need to do is get the transposon into the host. And that sometimes is the rate-limiting step, okay? And that's where we come down to this last point here, which is a delivery vector, or a vehicle to get the transposon into the host that you want to mutagenize. And you want that delivery vehicle to disappear. That's why we call it a suicide vehicle. And it's analogous to what we talked about in the earlier lecture when we talked about doing the allelic exchange. When you bring in the allele that's going to be exchanged, you want the vehicle that's bringing in that piece of DNA to be lost. And the ways that you do that, again, is analogous to what we talked about earlier, is that your vehicle, whether it's a plasmid or a phage, would have a defect in replication. So they would fail to replicate in your target. So it's conditionally defective for replication. Perhaps if it's a plasmid, you can use the principle of plasmid incompatibility to introduce the plasmid into the strain, and then to chase that plasmid out by introducing a plasmid of the same incompatibility group. And we talked about incompatibility groups for plasmids and how you can select for one of those two plasmids and it will chase out the other one in the absence of selection for the second one. And you can do counter-selection. And again, think about what we talked about when we talked about allelic exchange. Having the markers that you can select in a forward fashion and in a reverse fashion. Like TEP resistance. You can select the TEP resistance, and at the same time, that gives a selection in the opposite direction because you can select the fusoric acid resistance, which gives you loss of the TEP gene. Okay? That's what we mean by a counter-selection here. So let's just go back and look real quickly at an example of a suicide vector. And I introduced this on Tuesday when we talked about introducing TN10 into a strain in order to do mutagenesis with this transposon. And the suicide vector we used in this case is a bacteriophage lambda, which has these features. It has a mutation in the N gene, which controls late gene expression, that is lytic expression. It has a mutation in the P gene, which controls DNA replication, again for the lytic phase. It has a deletion, which is defined as deletion 221, which is the deletion of a large stretch of phage DNA that encodes both the INT genes and the excision genes, which would be necessary for going lysogenic. And it deleted out some non-essential genes for phage replication. So the reason why this deletion was used is because remember how phase lambda was packaged into the phase head. You can't put in more than the normal phase size. So in order to accommodate the 10 kilobases of the TN10, you need to remove some of the phage DNA so that you can package that DNA in the phage head. So that's why they use this deletion. And also it removed genes which are essential for going lysogenic. So when this phage is used to infect a sensitive E. coli, the phage can't replicate because it can't go lytic. It can't integrate because it's missing the integration genes. So basically it's a dead DNA molecule in this host. So if you apply selection now for tetracycline resistant in these strains, what you will find are those strains which have acquired TN10 in the chromosome by transposition. And they will be stably tet resistant because the phage is not going to be replicated. It will be lost in the population. So the only tet resistant survivors then in the selection will be those which have acquired the tetracycline resistance by transposition from the phage genome onto the chromosome of the bacteria. So that illustrates again how you do your random mutagenesis, but also some of the features that are necessary in order to prevent your vector, which is bringing the transposon in, prevent that vector from replicating. NAM-PAN. This is NAM is the gene N, and the mutation is an AMBA mutation. Same thing for P. Because if you start thinking about this, you're going to be thinking, well, if it can't replicate, how do you get the DNA in protocols? If the phage can't replicate, how do you make the phage? And I'm going to be standing up here looking stupid and thinking, geez, you know, you can draw it out on paper, but you can't replicate the phage. And I'd be wrong. So how do you replicate the phage? This gets you, force you to think about some earlier concepts in this course too. Right. And that's why the NAM fan is important. How do you replicate this phage? You could with a helper phage, but then you have, you could, yeah. But that's not how this is done. It's actually easier than that. Pardon? PCR? No. That's the easy answer. This is full 50 kilobases in size. You're not going to amplify 50 kb of DNA. So how you, and again, think about who's asking the question. I'm lazy. I'm going to do PCR with this. You're going to put it into an E. coli, it'll replicate. Exactly. Which E. coli are we going to use? Can you make that stuff? Not a radio station.
Maybe?
Yeah. No. I didn't need that. What? No.
I got nothing.
No, you got nothing. Who's got something? Think about it. It's a really easy answer to think about.
Another bacteria having the lysosome of the same thing?
No, that would be similar to what Diana was saying with respect to using a helper phage. It's even easier way. Why do you even mention that the mutations were AMBA mutations? Why is that important? Actually, that is important. Why is that important?
Something
to do with some kind of stop codon. It got to be more precise. Well,
like a mutation and a certain stop codon.
That's what AMBA mutation is, right? Yeah, that's what AMBA mutation is. So why is that important to answer this question? Right. Right. Well, what do we call that DNA? Now it's a suppressor mutation, right? The suppressor mutation, the suppressor tRNA, recognizes a stop codon, reads through, right? So how do you replicate this phage? You put it in E. coli that has a suppressor tRNA, and it'll read through the AMBER stops. The phage will replicate. Right? That's why you use AMBER mutations here, because in a appropriate E. coli background, you can replicate and propagate the phage. In this target strand that you're mutagenizing, as long as it doesn't have a suppressor tRNA, the phage won't replicate. It's a dead molecule. So that's why the AMBA mutations are important. I'm glad you brought that up. Okay, so how do you generally do transposon mutagenesis? It's really quite simple. It's similar to what I showed in the previous slide. If you want to mutagenize the chromosome, you bring the DNA in on a plasmid or a phage. And in this case, Your book is using the example of mobilizing a Coli-1 plasmid that had the transposon on it from a donor into a recipient, and using a conjugated plasmid, RP4, which it in and of itself has mutations, so it can't be transferred, but it supplies the transfer genes or the transfer proteins in trans, so that the Coli-1 will be mobilized into the target strain. And in this target strain of E. coli, it doesn't have the proteins that are necessary for replication of the Coli-1 vector. So the Coli-1 vector in this case would be a suicide vector because the recipient bacterium can't replicate it. So once the plasmid is transferred from the donor into the recipient, the plasmid doesn't replicate. If you apply selection for the transposon, which includes kanamycin resistance, then what you will find will be random insertions in the chromosome and the host.
So that was the last one, suicide vector. If they're putting it into E. coli with the expressed
DNA, that's how we made the phage in the first place. That was the point I was making here. So how do you make the phage?
Okay.
Right. Because you know why it doesn't replicate.
Then you take the thought and put it into an E. coli that
right.
does not replicate.
Right. Don't forget, the normal state of the E. coli is normal tRNAs. You can isolate suppressor tRNAs in mutants, which are suppressor strains of E. coli, and that's the strain that you go to lysate. Okay, so then this is a way that you can deliver the transposon using a plasmid and mobilizing it by conjugation. You can also introduce the TN5 on a suicide vector and mutagenize plasmid targets. So this is another case, an example that your book shows where you've introduced the TN5 on the suicide vector, and then I'll specify which one it is. And that's okay because we've already discussed that. And the TN5 will hop onto the plasmid. But if you think about it, the plasmid, little piece of DNA here, chromosome, a huge piece of DNA. Where do you think most of the insertions are going to go? In space? Said space. Devita, what do you say? Chromosomes, not going on the chromosomes. How do you sort out those events? What you want are, I want targets, I want insertions in my plasmid here. I don't care about the ones in the chromosome, but they're going to happen. You go to culture up, the chain plasmid is going to hop into the plasmid, it's going to hop into the chromosome. More of them are going to hop into the chromosome because it's a bigger target. So how do you sort out these events, which I want from these events? And it's really easy. And it's like the plasmid DNA. So you get a bunch of the plasmid DNA. Get an isolate, a large quantity of plasmid DNA. Some of those plasmids will have insertions in them. Those are the ones that you're interested in. So you've already teased out a subpopulation of the events that you want. You take that DNA, transform a new recipient, and select for what? Kanamycin resistance. And that's where you'll find those plasmids in this population which have received an insertion. So it's really quite simple and straightforward because you've got selection on your side all the way through. And this is how you isolate insertion events in a plasmid, even though you're going to get insertions in a variety of other places that you're not interested in. This selective pressure, the selectable marker on the transposon, allows you to focus in on those events. So once you get insertions into the plasmid, how do you know where those insertions are? Well, there are a couple ways that you can do that. You can take the DNA, you can take the plasmid DNA of the unmutagenized plasmid, do a restriction digest, and map it, run that on the gel, so that you have the restriction pattern of the unmutagenized plasmid. And you compare it to your mutagenized plasmids. And you look at the number and sizes of the fragments, and they'll be different, right? Because you've added DNA to the plasmid. So if you look at the restriction digest, you will find a fragment from the unmutagenized strain, which is now gone. Because you've got a transposon that is inserted in it, which will change its size. You can also identify specifically where your transposon has inserted by doing a southern blot and using a radio label or other label probe based on the transposon. And that will identify which of those new fragments of DNA that you see in the mutagenized plasmid contains the transposon. And now, because of the ease of doing sequencing, if you have the original sequence of your unmutagenized plasmid, and you know that sequence, then you can sequence out from the ends of the transposon into the adjacent sequence, and that will define the insertion junction, where your transposon has inserted. And that will specifically tell you where in the target plasmid your transposon has inserted. So these are a couple of different approaches to mapping where your transposon is when you pop it into the chromosome. Again, the second approach requires that you need to know the sequence of the target plasmid that you're using. Now, those are ways that you can use transposons for doing in vivo mutagenesis. You can also do now in vitro transposition, because we know a lot more about the enzymology that's involved in doing transpositions. And I'll talk about specifically TN5, although systems exist and they're commercially available for doing in vitro transposition using TN5 or using those Mariner types of transposons, which we talked about on Tuesday. And the TN5 system is called a transposome. And it's very simple and requires very few component parts. And that's what's shown here. The enzyme is a transposase. We talked about that before. We talked about transposons. This is what's important for making the hops happen. In addition, you require a substrate, which is a piece of DNA that has DNA sequences at the ends, which are recognized by the enzyme, the transposons. So you start off with the enzyme plus the appropriate substrate. And when you mix them together, and this is, again, talking about specifically TN5, when you mix these two together, what you end up with is an activated complex that's called the transposome. And the transposome contains the transposase attached to the ends of the DNA. And this is a molecule now that is ready to hop. In the absence of magnesium, it's a stable complex that's activated, ready to hop, but it's got nowhere to go just yet. Yeah. No, it's not.
Where is it to be found?
This is found in the literature for Epicenter, which is a company that developed the technology. And I'll give you the reference from Joe Resnikoff's lab, who developed the technology. You have to look back to the original lecture. So think about how TN5 works. And you can think of the different steps that are involved here. The TN5 in vitro, when you form this complex, has the outside ends, which are the ends of the molecule that's recognized by the transposase. And what this will do is it will insert randomly into the target DNA by making a 9 base paired staggered nick in the target. Remember how these transposons work, and when you've got staggered nicks, which will leave these overhangs, which will be filled in, and that's why you get these repeats at the ends of the insertion site. So this is how the transposon moves into the target and leaves these gaps, and those gaps are going to be repaired inside of the host after this molecule is transferred into the E. coli. So what Phil Resnikoff and his postdocs did was to take the TN5 and make it better. So remember, the enzyme which is important for hopping is that transposase. You can purify the transposase and make those complexes, which I showed you in the previous slide. And what they did was they isolated mutations in the transposase gene so that now they increase the efficiency of hopping. So one mutation, for example, increases the efficiency of binding of the enzyme to its targets at the ends of the transposon, and that increases the transposition frequency tenfold. Other mutations block synthesis of the inhibitor of the transposase, decrease dimerization function, and also enhances transposition. So basically, they genetically engineer this transposon to work better and more efficient. And again, if you mix transposase with the target, with the transposon DNA, and again, what it shows here is that this DNA can be anything as long as it's got the ends of TN5. Because that's where the enzyme is going to be recognized in the site. So anything in between is fine, fair game. And you get this transposon structure. That can be then mixed with the target DNA in a test tube. and it will drive transposition events so that when you transform the DNA into E. coli, you'll end up with these insertions which form. So you don't need any suicide vector to introduce the DNA that has the transposon. You're directly introducing the transposon with its enzyme and targeting the DNA. So the structure of this transposome is kind of important. Because what you'll see is that it just has the ends of the transposon and a selectable marker. In this case, it's kanamycin resistant. What's missing is the gene for the transposons. So what you can see here is that when this molecule of DNA hops, it's permanent. It's stable. It's not going anywhere because it doesn't have enzymes. It doesn't have the gene to encode the enzymes that would allow it to hop. What you've done is you've taken that gene out of play because you mix the enzyme, which is a product of that gene, directly with this DNA and the target, and thus you get these random hops into your target. And those hops will be stable because the enzyme will degrade and the transposon itself doesn't have the genes for encoding any of that enzyme. So these hops will be stable. So that's another reason why the important structure here is the ends of the transposon, the ends that are recognized by that enzyme. Yes? Enzymes, proteins degrade. They're going to be diluted out in cell division, and eventually they'll be degraded by proteases in the cell. So this is the transposition using what Epicenter calls EZTN mutagenesis. EZ stands for, they're lazy too, it's just easy to do. That's all. You can also do what they call transpositions in vivo. And in this case, what they do is they make those transposons, which is the piece of DNA that's mixed with the enzyme, and then just electroporate that complex directly into electrocompetent cells. And when the complex is electroporated into the cells, that's where it's exposed to the magnesium, which allows the complex to hop. And that's where you get random insertions into the genome of the target cell. So what they have developed this for, what they're marketing this for, is for mutagenesis of bacteria that are genetically intractable for analysis or to manipulate. So if you don't have easy ways of introducing plasmids or phages into the strain, you can do the mutagenesis by using these transposomes and directly introducing the transposome molecule into the cell and generating mutations in that way. And one last feature that is really very nice is that if you don't particularly care for kanamycin resistance, you can make your own transposome. So they have plasmids which look like this that have a multiple cloning site that is flanked by the outer ends of TN5. And then you can introduce any gene that you want into that multiple cloning site, and you've created your own transposome. Because again, the important feature of the mobile element here is the outside ends of TN5, and that's what's shown here. So you can basically put any gene you want right into that multiple cloning site, and you've created your own transposome, which will hop when you add the transposase enzyme to it. How big? That's a good question. I don't know if they've actually looked at how much DNA you can put in there. I suspect that the bigger the piece of DNA, the less efficient the transposition will be. So people will tend to put smaller pieces of DNA rather than try to create larger volume. Yes?
Why don't you just
say
that,
like
let me describe it, that you can TN, you know, you explain it, I actually understand that. Mm-hmm. So why
would you just use that?
Yeah, why bother with like suicide vectors, all these things that seem really confusing and hard to control?
That's a good question. In fact, we've done it both ways in Shigella. And in one case, the EZTN didn't work very well. In the other case, Lambda worked fabulous. So depending on your system, one may work better than the other. So I wouldn't recommend one over the other. I would just say, these are the tools which are in the toolbox. Try it one way. I would say do the easy way first. If it doesn't work, go to plan B. I just want to make sure that you're aware of the different ways that these things can be done now with the differences and the advances in technology. So 10 years ago, the easy transposon system didn't work. You have to use one of these suicide vectors. now you do have the system available, and it's being used in a lot of different organisms, but some are working better than others. Gene fusions. So gene fusions are used for studying either gene expression or protein expression. And remember, well, I'll point out again the importance of understanding the difference between operon fusions and protein fusions. So operon fusions will look at transcriptional regulation and also the organization of your operons. Protein fusions study protein expression, and they will be useful for looking at post-transcriptional regulation of genes that are tough to access. So we'll see examples of where you can make protein fusions that allow you to follow gene expression of your gene in the absence of good tools for studying the particular gene. So if you had an enzyme that was difficult to assay, and you wanted to measure how that particular enzyme was synthesized or expressed, it would be difficult to measure that just by looking for the enzymatic activity. You can replace that gene with a gene that encodes an enzyme which is much easier to assay, such as the gene for beta glycosidase. So that's how you can isolate these fusions in order to detect proteins and protein expression that is normally much more difficult to assay. Similarly, if you have no assay for expression of that particular gene, you can study its regulation by making the fusion, because it gives you a marker. It gives you what we call a reporter for looking at expression of that particular gene. And again, you can study it at the level of transcription, and you can study it at the level of post-transcriptional events. A lot of what is done in molecular biology today involves using gene fusions for tagging proteins. And you probably all have heard at one point or another examples of where people have made gene fusions in order to map epitopes of different proteins or to create fusion proteins which have multiple functions. People have used gene fusions to follow the localization of proteins in bacterial cells, even in mammalian cells. So when you make fusions of your protein of interest to a marker, which is easy to follow, again, we call those reporters, then you can look at protein localization. One of the more popular ones, I think, that you probably have heard of, is some of these fluorescent tags, like there's green fluorescent protein or red fluorescent protein. When you make fusions of those proteins to your gene of interest, you can follow localization of your protein by following that reporter and where that reporter goes. Similarly, you can look at protein-protein interactions using these reporter genes, making these reporter fusions. Because if you have a protein, for example, and you have no reagents for detecting that protein, you don't have antibody to it, you make a fusion of that protein with another protein for which you do have reagents. Let's say you tag it with a 6-histidine tag, or you tag it with a hemagglutinin tag. So that now you have a protein fusion. You can look at protein-protein interactions because you have reagents for that other motif that you've added to your protein. So the types of fusions are as follows: operon fusions and protein fusions. The operon fusions are transcriptional, protein fusions are translational. Your operon fusion places your reporter gene with its native translational start site under control of an outside promoter, under control of the heterologous promoter. So if we take the case of LACZ in this case, that's going to be your reporter gene. Your operon fusion will be the LACZ gene with its own ATG start site for translation, but no promoter for LACZ. Doesn't have a LAC promoter. And that will be placed under control of a different promoter, a heterologous promoter. And that heterologous promoter, GeneX, then will drive expression of your reporter gene. So one can study regulation of expression of GeneX because you've fused a reporter of GeneX to the reporter gene. You fuse the promoter for GeneX to the reporter gene, which is LACZ. So now you can follow expression of this gene by looking at expression of LACZ. A protein fusion is different in that it places your reporter gene under the control of both transcriptional and translational start sites. So if you look again at the case of LACZ, it would be and lack Z gene that doesn't have its own promoter and doesn't have the ATG start site and is missing the first, I think in this case, like 5 or 6 amino acids of the open reading clinical oxygen. That would give you translational or protein fusions. And what it would look like is what you see here, which is a slide that's taken from your book, a transcriptional fusion. The LAC-Z gene that has its own ATG start site, it has assigned Delgarno sequence, recognition sequence, so that ribosomes can recognize it, and it is fused to the promoter for open-reading clin A. And what you get in this fusion then is the messenger RNA, which is a hybrid message that contains part of the open-reading clin A, to which your LAC-Z reporter is fused, and it contains the coding sequence for LAC-Z, which includes the start site for translation of LAC-Z. So it's a hybrid message that, when translated, gives you two protein products, a truncated piece of open-reading clin A and an intact, fully functional, enzymatically functional LAC-Z. So the importance of using LAC-Z is because it's easy. It's got an easily detectable phenotype on agar medium. You use X-gal plates, you can use the Conkey plates. It has a quantitative and very easy to use colorimetric assay for measuring enzyme activity. And all of the power of the LAC operon system is available now for modulating expression of these genes and using that reporter gene to isolate other types of mutations. That's why LAC-Z is a good report. It's not the only one. I think it's illustrated to use here because it's a really powerful system for looking at gene expression. So again, we're thinking about making these fusions. Some of the components that you need for a fusion vector would be having a transposon to make your insertions for you. So it has to have the transposon end, you need the transposase gene. And again, you want the transposase to be located outside of the transposon. So when the transposon hops, it'll be stable. They'll leave behind the transposase gene. That will be lost because you've got a suicide vector that's going to disappear. A selectable marker, any drug resistant marker would be great, and your reporter gene, such as LAC-Z. So what we're thinking about here is a system for creating random insertions into a genome so that you can look at expression of genes by not looking at a particular phenotype, but by looking at expression of this reporter gene. So an example of an operon fusion vector would be, again, going back to our old friend Lambda, which has, in this case, a structure that looks like this. We have the LAC-Z gene, which is missing the promoter. It's missing the promoter, but it has its own transcriptional start, a translational start site. It's fused to TRIP here, just a fragment of the TRIP, but it has the ends of a transposable element here so that when this bacteriophage circularizes, the entire phage hops and places the LAC-Z gene in the into a gene like gene X, so that you now get the transcription of the LAC-Z gene through the end of the transposome, the transposon end, from the promoter for the gene X. So here's just a random insertion of the phage. Not as a phage, but it's driven by these transposon ends here, which are in black, and the whole phage gets inserted into the chromosome. And as you can see here, similar to what we saw on the previous slide, the promoter for gene X now makes a single transcript, it's a hybrid transcript that will be translated into a truncated piece of the protein from open reading from X and a fully intact LAC-Z about the size of part. So how would you use this? This type of mutagenesis has been used to map all of the genes which are in the SOS regulon. So if you think about the genes that are induced when the bacteria is undergoing SOS stress, DNA damage, UV damage, there were a number of those genes which were identified, but people wanted to ask, have we identified all the genes that are induced by the SOS response? And since you don't know the answer to that question, you don't know what the phenotypes of those genes would be. You can't select those genes or screen for them very easily. But what you can do is say, give me all of the genes that are regulated in the same fashion when the bacteria is exposed to DNA damage. That is, give me all of the genes that are regulated by the SOS response. And if you use the operon fusion technique which we just described, you can then look for all of the genes which respond in the same fashion by looking for all the genes which turn on expression of your reporter gene in the same fashion. And your reporter gene is LAC-Z in this case, so you have something that you can directly screen for. Similarly, we use the technique to look for all of the genes which are temperature regulated in Shigella, because we found that virulence in Shigella, its ability to invade and replicate in epithelial cells, is regulated by temperature. The phenotype is turned on at 37 degrees, it's turned off at 30 degrees. So you can then apply that information and design an experiment to look for genes which you haven't been able to identify yet and for which you don't have any easily selectable phenotype. So you take a wild type strain of Shigella and infect it with your lambda that contains the operon fusion vector, and those transposition events will happen on the plasmid, they'll happen in the chromosome, and what you're looking for here then are kanamycin-resistant colonies, those bacteria which have received transposition events, and you can then select for those hops which occur that place that LAC-Z reporter gene in the right orientation so that it's expressed by a promoter that's turned on at 37 degrees. Because we know that virulence is expressed at 37 degrees, so we're looking for all those reporter insertions which are on at 37 degrees. For the 21 minimal plate with lactose as a sole carbon source, only those hops which occur that place that reporter in the same orientation with the promoter that's turned on at 37 will be selected and will grow. And then you can screen those and score them and say, okay, of this constellation of insertions to these thousands of different promoters which are expressed at 37, how many of those promoters are turned off at 30 degrees? So you just plate them out and screen. Presence of growth of the colonies at 37, you can replicate them if you want. How many of them don't grow at 30? And the ones that don't grow at 30 are temperature regulated. So that's how you can use the LAC-Z gene as a reporter and say, aha, here are genes which are very distinctly temperature regulated. Of course, we know the promoters are turned on at 37 and turned off at 30. Now we can test and see whether or not those insertions affect virulence and whether, if as predicted, those insertions are in genes which are not just temperature regulated, but are also genes that are important for invasion and virulence for Shigella. And that's how you can use these operon fusions to look for genes which are otherwise hard to find by just phenotype. Now, another way that this is used is a technique that I think Scotty will be talking about when he talks about the genomics in January, and that's the IBET selection strategy. And that uses a similar type of approach that allows you to look for expression of genes in vivo, genes that are turned on in vivo, that are turned off in vitro. And that's what the IBET system is. It looks for in vivo expression of genes. So I won't go into any detail about this because Scotty's going to be talking about it, but it uses the same principle that I just talked about with respect to gene fusions, operon fusions. The same approach can be used with different reporters. I gave you the example of using a reporter that was based on LAC-Z. Another type of reporter is illustrated here that uses GFP. And this particular reporter is a fluorescence lab. So you can look at genes which are expressed by looking for expression of the green fluorescent protein. And this can be done by doing cell sorts. You can run it through a cell sorter and just look for expression of the genes in vivo. In this case, this would be looking at insertions that you've made into a bacterium such as Salmonella, and then use them to infect macrophages or epithelial cells, and then screen those infected cells for those Salmonella inserts that have their protein, the operon fusion made to genes which are turned on when the bacteria are inside the cells and turned off when the bacteria are outside the cells. In this case, you've made a fusion of the promoter to a reporter. And the reporter is the GFP. The GFP has its own translational start site, but its expression is dictated by that promoter. And that promoter is either turned on or off, and you use the cell sorter to look for when those genes are turned on inside of the infected cells. It's another way of looking at in vivo expression using this technology. Okay, let's switch then to protein fusions. And protein fusions are translational fusions. So in this case, the reporter gene, LACZ, GFT, whichever you're interested in, is controlled by both transcriptional factors and translational factors. So it depends for its expression on an exogenous promoter as well as an exogenous ATG and trimethylguanine. It doesn't have its own promoter, it doesn't have its own translational start. So when you make these fusions, the only way that the reporter will be expressed is if the fusion is, number one, in the right orientation in the gene. Because one of the things we talked about with the Acron fusion is that those insertions can go in either orientation, right? The insertion is flipped. You're not going to get expression because the promoter is not pointing into the gene. So it's orientation dependent. Protein fusions are not just orientation dependent, but because you don't have a translational start, the insertion has to be in the correct open reading frame. Okay? Does that make sense? So it has to be in the right orientation, but it also has to be in the right reading frame. So even if you've got the right orientation, one of three of those insertions is going to be expressed. The other ones are going to be out of frame, and you won't get an active protein being translated. So that's what's shown on this slide. And again, it just illustrates the fact that the reporter, in this case LACZ, doesn't have its own ATG start, it doesn't have its own trimethylguanine, it doesn't have its own promoter. It depends on the exogenous gene into which it's been inserted to provide all of those functions. So what you get is, similar to the Acron fusion, a hybrid message that's made. But you get now, in this case, a hybrid protein being synthesized. So that the N-terminal end of the protein comes from the exogenous gene into which you've inserted the fusion, which is ORF-A. And that is fused to, at the C-terminal end, the reporter gene, in this case, LACZ. So one can easily see that if the insertion here is out of frame, you will get a protein that doesn't look anything like that, like LACZ, because it will be translated out of frame. Now this just illustrates the insertion in the correct orientation in the correct open reading frame at the fusion joint here, so that you get a hybrid protein, which is functional for LACZ. So what I should point out here is that the hybrid protein has to maintain its reporter activity, otherwise it's no good to you. What I didn't say is that in the original creation of these fusions, it was discovered that not only can you remove the first, I don't know, maybe 20 amino acids of LACZ, and it still has beta-lactosidase activity, but you can also add many, many amino acids, 50, 100 amino acids to the N-terminal end of beta-lactosidase, and it still retains protein activity, still retains enzymatic activity. So that's another reason why the LACZ gene, beta-lactosidase, is a really good reporter, not just for alkaline fusions, but also for translational fusions, because it retains its activities even though you've added to it some upstream sequence at the N-terminal. Some enzymes won't be active if you modify them in this fashion. So that's why you got to be very careful when you're making fusion proteins or you're tagging proteins, because the tag itself may affect enzymatic activity. LACZ is very, very flexible in this sense, and that can accept a lot of DNA at that end. So as I said, the requirements for your reporter to be expressed are that the insertion has to be in the correct orientation, so the promoter is pointing in toward the reporter gene, and in the case of the protein fusion, it has to be in the right reading frame, so that you get production of a fusion protein which has activity. Now, one caveat for using beta-galactosidase is that the subcellular localization is going to determine the activity of the hybrid protein. And beta-galactosidase is a cytoplasmic enzyme. It does not like to be stuck in the membrane. So if the fusion that you've created, whoops, oh, yeah. If the fusion that you've created is the diffusion you've created is going to be sent to the membrane because this N-terminal N has signals for localization to the membrane. The LAC-Z gene is going to get stuck. The LAC-Z product is going to get stuck in the membrane because it's big and it folds. And that'll jam up the secretion machinery. So the N-terminal N of proteins, which tend to have signals for localization in the bacterial cell, is going to be really important for determining where the hybrid protein is going to go. And you can actually use this, and has been used as a tool, to look for subcellular localization of proteins and to select the mutants which are defective in localization. So you can easily see that if the hybrid protein that you make is driving the LAC-Z hybrid protein to the membrane, and the bacteria are sick and don't tolerate that, what you can do is you can isolate spontaneous mutants, which grow much better, and look for where those mutations are. And those mutations may be in here, as you might expect. Maybe the protein now, because the bacteria is synthesizing and growing better, is because you've isolated spontaneous mutations in the targeting sequence, which now fails to target your hybrid protein to the membrane. So you can use these different phenotypes, again, of the LAC system to isolate specific mutations and use those to isolate pathway mutants. So beta-galactosidase, again, has these different features. It's a large protein. It also tetramerizes, which is another reason why it doesn't like to go to the membrane. It's active in the cytoplasm. The N-terminal N, as I mentioned, is dispensable. And you can get those unusual phenotypes if you have fusions, which will drive it across the cytoplasmic membrane. Another reporter gene, which is really very useful in a specific application, is the gene for alkaline phosphatase. This is the FOA gene. This is a protein, an enzyme, which is functional as a dimer. And it only has activity when it's in the protoplasm. The protoplasmic environment is what activates the protein and gives it its active form. So the protein has to be transferred across the cytoplasmic membrane into the protoplasm for it to be active, for the dimerization occurring for it to have activity. The activity of alkaline phosphatase can be measured by using a colorimetric substrate, which is based on the same chemistry as XGAL, and that's why it's called XP. And this is a colorless dye, which when cleaved by alkaline phosphatase becomes blue. So it works exactly the same way, or analogously to the way that XGAL works in beta-galactosidase. So the way that you can take advantage of this particular gene as a reporter gene for making protein fusions is to take the gene, remove the promoter, the translational start signal. And in this case, the signal which drives the protein to the membrane, the first five amino acids of alkaline phosphatase, is what's necessary for driving it to the membrane. So this particular structure has been used in a transposon, it's called TNFOA. And this is used to create protein fusions and look for those proteins which are secreted. So this is a specific application of a protein fusion to look for protein export signals. Because here you have a protein which is only active when it's exported across the cytoplasmic membrane. And it has specific signals for that transport. So if you remove those signals, the protein is cytoplasmic and it's inactive. When you've created fusions then, two other genes and create protein fusions now to genes which have a periplasmic domain, which target your hybrid protein to the protoplasm, then the FOA is going to be active. And you can select those, you can screen for those. Fusions of your TNFOA through proteins which stay in the cytoplasm will be negative because they'll never get across the cytoplasmic membrane. They don't have the targeting signals. So this is a way that you can look for genes which encode proteins that are going to be targeted into the protoplasm or out to the outer membrane just by using this TNFOA. So this is what the molecule looks like. It's a typical transposon structure. You've got the ends of the transposable element, IS50. So this is derived from TN5. It has kanamycin resistance. It has the transposase enzyme. And it has FOA, but a truncated FOA that's missing not just the promoter, not just the Shine Delgado, but it's also missing the signals that transport this protein across the cytoplasmic membrane. And when this transposon inserts into gene X, if gene X is a gene that is that encodes a protein that does get targeted, so it has targeting sequences at the N-terminal end, you will get production of a fusion protein that contains protein X with its targeting signals and ProA. That goes out across the membrane. You've got a kind of mycin-resistant organism, which is now ProA positive. And you can look for those on these X-down or XP codes. So that's how you can look for positive protein fusions to proteins that are secreted by using ProA. And your book also illustrates an example of how ProA is used to look at mapping membrane topology for membrane proteins that have cytoplasmic and protoplasmic loops. You make random insertions in the open reading frame, and you look for those insertions which are expressed because those domains are in protoplasm, and those insertions which don't give you active alkaline phosphatase because those domains remain in the cytoplasm. This is how you can look for these types of fusions in map membrane topology. So let me just finish by mentioning that of all of these types of gene fusions we talked about, creating them in vivo, you have a lot of applications now which are done in vitro, where people construct in a test tube fusions of promoters, the genes, so that you can inducibly regulate expression of the genes. We have a variety of different types of promoters, like the LAC promoter, which is inducible with lactose, repressible with glucose, the lambda PL promoter, the left promoter, which is repressed by lambda repressor protein, C1. You've got the promoter for the arabinose alkaline, which is inducible by arabinose and repressed by glucose, and the T7 promoter, which is responsive to T7 RNA polymerase. So you can use these different promoters to control expression of your gene of interest. And there are a variety of vectors that have these promoters that allow you to make those types of fusions. And those would be similar to alkaline fusions, because your expression is dictated by the presence of this exogenous promoter. Similarly, you can create in a test tube, in vitro, protein fusions by adding tags to the N-terminal end or to the C-terminal end of your gene of interest. They include HIS tags, anywhere from 6 to 10 histidine residues consecutively. The viral hemagglutinin, or HA tag, which is a relatively small tag as well. The GST tag, which is glutathione S-transferase, which is larger. And all of these were chosen because there are specific reagents for identifying them, like the HIS tag. Antibodies are available for that. You can also purify HIS tag proteins by specific columns, which take advantage of the particular chemical properties of having a string of histidine residues. These are nickel columns. The viral hemagglutinin is small, so it's not likely to interfere with the activity of your proteins. And again, specific immunological tags for immunological reagents for purifying proteins that will mark with these tags. And the same thing for GST, and then obviously the GFP tag, which we talked about, is a fluorescence tag so you can follow your protein using that. So this is just a way of closing the discussion by telling you how we use transposons for doing mutagenesis, for creating fusions, but also as an outgrowth of all of that activity, we now have lots of different ways for specifically creating fusions in a test tube to your gene of interest for purifying, for following the localization, for controlling expression. And all of these are based on creating fusions to promoters or fusions to specific sequences or motifs to create hybrid proteins. So I want you to remember it is the difference between these operon fusions and the translational fusions, and which of them are going to be controlled by which specific elements, like the promoters, and which of them are going to create the hybrid proteins, such as the ones we're talking about in this slide. Okay, are there any questions on today's material? Just give you enough time to run off to your next task, right? Brutal today, but again, we have a little lecture.